One of the more famous observations by political advisors recently is that perception is reality, but that might also apply to the ways we respond to films based on real events. For this installment of Political Projections, our year-long election-related film series, we look at the ways Hollywood has depicted the lives, or in one case, the death, of presidents on film. The three films that we've chosen are JFK, Truman, and Young Mr. Lincoln. And if you've watched any of them, we invite you to leave a comment about them on our website at WNYC.org. But joining me now are film critic David Thompson, author of Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films. It's published by Knopf. David, it's great to welcome you back to the show.
Very nice to be back with you.
And also with us is Georgetown University Associate Professor Jay Parker. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Jay, do you think that we should view the three film biographies we've chosen merely as historical representations of presidents or as commentaries on the eras that they were produced in?
It's a commentary on the era in which it was produced, and any time you show a film, how people respond to it is a commentary on the times in which it's seen. They're films that got tremendous public response when they were first distributed, and if you were to show them now, they would be completely discarded by folks, and there are other films that resonate as much now as they do when they were first released.
Well, let's talk about Young Mr. Lincoln, for example. Mm-hmm. John Ford made it in 1939 when the Depression was still raging mm-hmm. and war had broken out in Europe. Why do you think that Ford decided to make a film about Abraham Lincoln's early years as a lawyer in Illinois at that time?
Partly for the reasons that you just noted, the times in which he made the movie. There was a need or a search for heroes. There was a desire to see public figures as able to rise above the immediate crisis and take the longer view. And Lincoln is one of those presidents and public figures who people always come back to when they're looking for someone to represent that sort of leadership ideal.
David, do you think that audiences were expected to see parallels between Lincoln and FDR?
Oh, I'm sure they were, but I think it's also the feeling that war is coming. I think Ford had no doubt about that, and that mm-hmm. he knew that a crisis may be tougher than the Depression was coming. And it makes Young Mr. Lincoln almost a religious picture in a strange way, a religious picture for an agnostic society, perhaps. But there's a hallowed quality to it, a feeling that a country that can produce a kind of folksy, rural leader of this kind can be trusted, can be relied on. There isn't actually a close comparison between Lincoln and FDR. It's rather more the feeling that Lincoln is the salt of the earth, and that salt of the earth will be there again when we need it.
And FDR was a very patrician character.
Absolutely, yes. Lincoln is a very common figure, sort of from the countryside, of the countryside, and everything about him suggests that kind of rural America, which is harder and harder to find these days.
Were there, Jay, political groups in the 30s that were trying to appropriate the legacy of Abraham Lincoln?
Obviously, the Republican Party has always used Lincoln as their representative of what the party is supposed to stand for. But I think Lincoln had, by that point, transcended and being identified strictly by one party label and was viewed as someone who represented a nation as a whole. There's also to your point about the coming of war and the dangers that were lurking on the horizon, and I think this ties in with what David said as well. The very last scene when Henry Fonda is walking up over the hill and you see the storm clouds gathering and the wind is kicking up and he's walking into the storm, it sounds like a cliche when you say it, but when you look at it in the context of the film, and especially when you look at it in the context of other films made in that time, that kind of heroic image certainly ties in with the idea of a leader who will take us through the rough times and is not afraid to literally face the storm.
David, yeah. In the film, Lincoln defends two innocent men accused of murder. Why do you think that part of his history was chosen?
Well, I think it's a film that associates Lincoln and justice altogether. I don't think, as far as I know, that this case actually represents a case from Lincoln's own career. It's a fabricated case, but, you know, it's a case that reflects upon a nation that would still rush to judgment and justice in its own crude ways sometimes, and I think it's a stress upon meditation and reflection and reasoning, and maybe the best thing in the film is the ways in which, in a quite actly way, Lincoln teaches people how to look at evidence and how to think more deeply about issues.
But following up on what Jay said, do you think that the film can be thought of as a Western where the hero rides into town, saves
well,
the innocent, and then rides off, in this case, into a rainstorm instead of the sunset?
Absolutely. Well, it is a Western, or at least a rural picture. And of course, in the 30s, and this is not long after the death of Will Rogers, and Lincoln is a very Will Rogers-like figure. There were rural pictures and pictures that gloried in that kind of Americana, and I think it does fit with that, yeah.
But it has little, actually, Jay, it has little to do with Abraham Lincoln as a historical figure.
Actually, it did. This actually was a case. It was based on the case involving a William Armstrong. And Lincoln actually did take on this case, volunteered his services because he had some relationship with, I believe, with Armstrong's father, and it did bring a degree of notoriety to Lincoln as an attorney, and on a certain level, I think the Ford probably chose this case because it did depict in many ways a lot of the things that David just mentioned that Lincoln's associated with.
Well, let's play a little clip of Henry Fonda in the courtroom.
Your Honor, I protest against the prosecution's attempt to force this woman to decide which of her two sons shall live and which shall die. In her eyes, these boys hold an equal place.
Perhaps if my learned friend knew more of the law.
I may not know so much of law, Mr. Felder, but I know what's right and what's wrong. And I know what you're asking is wrong. Put yourself in this woman's place, Your Honor. Can you truthfully say you'd do differently? But look at her. She's just a simple, ordinary countrywoman. She can't even write her own name. Yet has she no feelings? No heart?
It's interesting. Earlier we had James McPherson on the show talking about his latest book about Lincoln, and I asked him if he thought that Lincoln was more like Henry Fonda or Royal Dana, and he said Henry Fonda.
Yeah. And, you know, Henry Fonda did not want to do this part originally because he thought the idea of playing Lincoln was just so intimidating to him, and then he was convinced to do a screen test, I guess. And once he saw himself in makeup, he decided, yeah, I should play this part. I don't know if it's because he saw the physical resemblance or it was just too great a part to pass up.
Well, we're going to go to a little break, but one more question before we go. The three films that we've chosen were all made many years after their subjects had died. Do you think something like HBO's Truman would have been radically different had it been made soon after he'd left office rather than in 1995? Or for that matter, if they'd been making movies in the end of the 19th century, would we have seen a similar image of Lincoln?
If it were in the case of Lincoln, because obviously he was so mythologized because of the circumstances of his death and the war, I think the tone probably would have been similar. I think given the public view and sort of the political fortunes of Harry Truman in 1952, if there had been a movie made in 1953 or 54, I don't think it would have been as balanced or favorable as Gary Sinise's portrayal.
We have to take a little break, as I said, and we'll be back with Professor Jay Parker of Georgetown University, Associate Professor Jay Parker, and with David Thompson, who is a film critic and historian. His latest book, Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films, which is published by Knopf. Have you heard about our new Redraw the Electoral Map Challenge? Pundits have been talking about how this year's electoral map could end up looking very different from the ones in past elections, and we're inviting you to get creative and drop your take on how this year's electoral map might end up looking. On October 24th, Andy Borowitz, the very funny Andy Borowitz, will join me to announce the winners and talk to them. But right now, go to our show page at WNYC.org to find out more. We're back with David Thompson and Associate Professor Jay Parker talking about presidential biopics on today's political projections. And let's talk a bit more about the Truman film. Unlike young Mr. Lincoln, Truman tries to cover the entire span of Harry Truman's life. Jay, the movie was based on David McCullough's biography of the president.
Yes.
Do you think that it makes a more accurate portrayal of his rise to power and presidency because it's based on a respected historian's book?
In part. Of course, to put into a little over roughly 2 hours, 2 hours and 15 minutes, everything that was significant in Truman's life would be a challenge, and obviously there was some picking and choosing. But I think also because McCullough's book was so widely known and so recent in publication, it would have been very difficult for the film to have strayed too far from the account that McCullough presented.
But what about the political climate of the time? 1995, Congress had been taken over by Republicans. So do you think the movie at all reflects the mood swing of the country?
Perhaps the way it was viewed. The one thing that that I always remind my students about movies is that if the movie was released in 1995, and you go back to the history of when it was developed, when they went through the process of getting greenlighted, how many times they went through stars who were signed on and were not, you're pushing yourself back to, you know, 93, 94 at a minimum. I think it probably depicts a lot of the conflict and the mood about the time of the 94 election, and if it represents a political event, it would probably be more the election of Clinton in 1992, the idea that a Democrat, particularly one who came from sort of a rural southern background as Clinton did, after a long period of the Reagan presidency, Ford and Bush 41, I think it may reflect that more than it does the mood after the Gingrich revolution and the takeover of Congress in 94.
But David, this was an HBO movie. It probably would have been different if it had been made for commercial release in the theaters.
Well, indeed, and I think that, you know, it's a moment to praise both HBO, which I think is really the only respectable film studio left, and also Frank Pearson, who made this film. Pearson is a director, a writer-director, who has earned a reputation for taking on historical subjects with great care. His most remarkable film, I think, is a film about the Wannsee Conference, where the future of the Jews was planned. It's a film in which Kenneth Branagh delivers a quite chilling portrait of Heydrich, is it? I think
yes.
Heydrich, as I remember.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I do think that you're dealing here with an author, someone who approaches the work with much more consideration for the facts. I think Ford cheerfully made the film out of conventions that he knew from other films. I do think that Frank Pearson made Truman as an attempt to grapple with the real figure. And I would have to say that I think the film got made because the book was a bestseller. Mm-hmm. I think that probably had more influence on it than any other thing you might find in politics at that time.
Well, let's play a clip
I would agree.
Let's play a clip in which President Truman talks about dropping the atomic bomb with his press secretary, Charlie Ross.
It's pronounced Hiroshima. If you're going to remove it from the face of the earth, you ought to know how to say it.
I didn't call on you for cheap sarcasm, Charlie. I was hoping for common sense.
They're telling you how many dead?
Oppenheimer, the chief scientist for the bomb, says it might kill as many as 30,000 people. With regular weapons, the firebombing of Dresden killed 30,000 in one night. Tokyo is utterly gone, with almost everyone in it. They figure 100,000 dead there.
Seems to me if there is a moral point of no return, you've long since passed it.
If I don't drop the bomb, so many more of our young men will die in the invasion of Japan. They're men too, and women and children. How could I face the people when it's finally over and say that I had the power to possibly end the war long ago? Spare the lives of their loved ones, and I chose not to use. How could I look them in the face and tell them that?
Harry, you didn't come to me for common sense. You came to me for forgiveness. Do what you have to do. I'll still be your friend.
But that really does come across as a defense of Harry Truman's decision, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
And it's also, I mean, this is not an event that is without controversy over what went into Truman's decision and how it was made. But in fact, as much as you can in a brief period, it pretty much capsulizes the core of the debate over that choice and Truman's own personal anguish and debate over what he should do in this instance.
At a time when people were questioning the wisdom of having dropped the atomic bomb.
It occurs to me, too, that you could take that speech and you could change the bomb to torture, and it would work quite well in a film made about much more recent events.
Well, there is a new film about the current president from Oliver Stone, which we are not going to discuss, although I have seen it. I'll talk about it some other time, I think perhaps with Oliver Stone. But we are the third film is Oliver Stone's JFK, which is not a straight chronological narrative like Truman. And it deals with President Kennedy's policies by looking at them through the lens of his assassination. Let's play a clip from the movie where a mysterious man played by Donald Sutherland confronts Jim Garrison, played by Kevin Costner, about the reasons for Kennedy's assassination.
The organizing principle of any society, Mr. Garrison, is the war. The authority of the state over its people resides in its war powers. And Kennedy wanted to end the Cold War in his second term. He wanted to call off the moon race in favor of cooperation with the Soviets. He signed a treaty with the Soviets to ban nuclear testing. He refused to invade Cuba in 1962, and he set out to withdraw from Vietnam. But all of that ended on the 22nd November, 1963. As early as 1961, they knew Kennedy was not going to go to war in Southeast Asia. Like Caesar, he is surrounded by enemies and something's underway. But it has no face, yet everybody in the loop knows.
David, you say that watching JFK is painfully close to watching a decent man go crazy. Are you just referring to Kevin Costner's character there or the whole film?
No. I think it's a biopic of Oliver Stone. I think it's about Oliver Stone's anxiety and his mounting feeling that he has been wronged by history and that he has to go back and make an extraordinary film. Let's say, first of all, that even if we loathe JFK, and I'm closer to loathing it, of the three films we're talking about today, it is the most dazzling, the most riveting, and it's the film that uses film best of all. That's why it's so tricky.
But he's going to be on our show this coming Thursday at noon.
Well, good luck. Wow.
Now, Jay, it covers a lot of ground on President Kennedy and the various theories about his assassination. Do you think the film had an impact on the public's views about whether there was a conspiracy?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. There were poll after poll that indicated that this was the belief of individuals after the film was made. Just the reaction of my own students when the subject would come up in class. And frankly, this is a film that just drove me crazy because, like David, I feel it was very technically well made, and some of it is just absolutely dazzling. But unfortunately for me, I'd spent years in the archives at the Johnson Library and the Kennedy Library and the Eisenhower Library and a host of other places, some of which are sources for authors who contributed to the screenplay. And this is, at best, a cut-and-paste version of a bumper sticker version of the events, and at worst, a distortion of many things. But, of course, Oliver Stone doesn't take kindly to individuals wanting to hold up historical fact to some of his screenplays.
But he does use
fights over this.
He does use real footage. In this case,
and
the Zapruder film, and then there's newsreel.
Yeah.
And in W, we have Brolin giving his speeches as George W. Bush, and then cut to Teddy Kennedy and John Kerry and others applauding.
Oh, absolutely. And I think David's point is well made. I mean, it's a tribute to, certainly not in my view, Oliver Stone as an historian, but Oliver Stone as not only a filmmaker, but as someone who has an appreciation for the art form that he works in. And his use of film within film, I think, is path-breaking and probably one of the more powerful aspects of the way he presents this story.
But David, all the films we've talked about have used real or altered newspaper clippings or to help move the story along, and that's also there to give them some verisimilitude?
Well, sure. And I think this is the reason ultimately why historians, and I side absolutely with Jay in this, have to put up very big warning signs over the movies.
Well, you've written that some movies have ruined our nation's sense of history.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm afraid to say that the language and the attitudes in Young Mr. Lincoln, it seems to me, can be located in our current president.
You say they're anti-democratic.
I think that sometimes films that set out to do one thing do something quite different. JFK, I think Oliver Stone intended to have the case reopened. I think what it actually did was to make a certain kind of paranoia deeper and more pervasive in the country. And I think that as a film that portrays a mood that began in the 60s, i.e., you can't trust a single thing you hear these days, JFK is quite remarkable, and it may be in time that if you want to show what the 60s and the 70s were like, it will be a very valuable film.
Well, there was already paranoia out there, and I guess to some degree this is all about what nobody trusts a biopic ever to be really historically accurate. It sort of tells us what we want to know at any given time, doesn't it? And I can't even wait for an answer, unfortunately, because I've run out of time, but I want to thank, at least that's my comment. My guests have been Georgetown University Associate Professor Jay Parker and David Thompson, author of Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films, which is published by Knopf. And it's been a lot of fun talking about these films with you. I guess they tell us a lot about what we want to know about our own history.
Yeah.
Amen.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
WNYC and WNYC.org. On tomorrow's show, a look at the history of Goldman Sachs and how it has managed to survive the financial crisis so far. Also, fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi with some tips on how we can all learn to look great. States of the Union is all about New Hampshire and the issues that matter most to Granite State voters. And then the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell, will be answering your home repair questions. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Fran Jacobs, Alex Simons, and Miranda Schaefer. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.